Emil Berliner was born in Hanover, Germany, in the year 1851. And when he was 19 years old, he moved to the United States, which would have been in 1870. He arrived in New York, but later moved to Washington, D.C., where he spent most of his life.
And what did he do at first? Is the years before he started to experiment?
His early years in the United States were spent trying to earn a living in studying acoustics and electricity. And he did the studying in two different ways. He obtained a book on electricity from Germany, and he began to study it with that book in his room in New York. College, university studies, classes in acoustics, and he took these classes at a New York institution, very famous now, called the Cooper Union, which has no record of Emil ever attending there because it turns out that he couldn't afford to be a student there, so he would, as we say, audit some classes. He actually went to class unofficially.
Now, around which time did he begin experimenting with, sound?
He experimented with sound about 1876. That was the year that Alexander Graham Bell introduced his telephone. And many people were fascinated by this amazing invention that talks to people and allows people to talk to it. It was well known that there were defects in Bell's design. The defects were mainly in what the telephone people call the telephone transmitter. We call it the microphone. At any rate, the Bell transmitter was so unreliable and so impotent that it would transmit your voice only about 20 feet. And my grandfather, who was about 26 years old at the time, was one of a number of people who were anxious to improve on Bell's telephone. And one of those people was Thomas Edison, by the way, who was already very well known. My grandfather learned by accident the principle of his improvement over the Bell telephone. He visited a friend who was a telegraph operator at one of the Washington, D.C. fire stations. All of the stations were connected to each other by telegraph. And he was invited to try his hand at sending code via a telegraph key. And when he started to press the key, the operator said, his friend said, no, Emil, you have to press harder on the key. Otherwise, they will not receive your signal at the other end of the line. You must press hard and make a very forceful, tight contact. In fact, the operator said, we can't use women as telegraph operators because they're not strong enough to hit the key hard enough to make a good long-distance transmission. This was the secret that my grandfather had been searching for. He realized instantly that, in effect, when their contact is tight, more current passes than when the contact is loose or gentle. He went back to his apartment in Washington and actually built a microphone using the loose contact principle. It worked. It was easy. It was obvious. But nobody knew it. In fact, all of the electricians at the time, and they were called electricians even though they were scientists, if they were working in electricity, they were called electricians. At any rate, they all knew that you must always have a tight contact to make good electrical, a complete electrical circuit. My grandfather realized that you don't want a tight contact in the case of telephony. You want a loose contact, a contact that varies with the person's voice or with any sound that is being picked up by the telephone, whether it's music or voice or the sound of a tree falling. So with this principle in mind, Grandpa built a microphone that demonstrated and proved the principle. He contacted the people at the Bell Telephone Company in Boston, which is where American Bell was headquartered. They were not in New York. They were headquartered in Boston. And he told them what he had created. Alexander Graham Bell sent his assistant, who was well known, Thomas Watson, as the man who, when Bell had hurt his hand in some experiment, he yelled to Mr. Watson, "Mr. Watson, come here. I want you." And that was the first voice ever heard over the telephone. Watson was in the other room and heard it on his receiving instrument. That was the same man who was Bell's assistant, who was sent to Washington to look at what Emil Berliner had invented. And Watson was very impressed with it, and he said, "Mr. Berliner, we will want that. You will hear from us." And of course, he did hear from them. And in 1878, the Bell system acquired the Berliner patent for the loose contact microphone, and the Berliner loose contact principle was used in all the world's telephones for the next 100 years. The interesting thing was, and I like to joke about it, was that my grandfather was offered $50,000 cash or $50,000 worth of Bell Telephone Company shares. And that's when he made his great mistake. He took the cash instead of the shares. Had he taken $50,000 worth of AT&T shares in 1878, when the Bell system was broken up by the U.S. government in 1984, his $50,000 worth of shares would have grown to, would you believe, $86 million in value. And I ask you not to believe that, because that's not the true figure. The true figure is $1,086,000,000. That's what happened to the value of AT&T shares from 1878 to 1984.
Okay. Now, what were his other achievements in recorded sound?
All right. With the money that he received from Alexander Graham Bell, he was able to call himself a professional inventor. Nowadays, if anyone says, "I am an inventor by trade," everyone laughs at him and knows that he is an unemployed crackpot. But in those early days, to call yourself an inventor was a mark of distinction, and Emil could call himself an inventor. He went to work for the Bell Company in addition to getting the purchase price of the telephone transmitter, eventually established the first telephone company in Europe, the Telephone Fabrik Berliner, which was begun in, I believe, 1879, that launched the telephone in Europe. Now, with the monies that he received for his work with Bell and for selling his patent to Bell, he was able to enjoy life and to spend his time on experimenting on other things. And one of the things that attracted his eye, remember, he was very interested in electricity and acoustics. And one of the things that attracted him was Edison's phonograph, which was a cylinder recorder player. It allowed sounds to be recorded on a cylinder and played back instantly. Edison called his invention the phonograph. He actually took credit for that word, which he did not originate. He actually took the word phonograph from the inventor of the actual method of sound recording, which was Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville in France, who in 1851 invented what he called the phonautograph, which is from the Greek words meaning sound signature. The phonautograph was the world's first sound recorder. It recorded on a cylinder, and this was 21 years before Edison introduced his phonograph. And he used the word phonautograph by removing the letters A-U-T. And when you do that, you come up with the word phonograph. That's how Edison got the word, and that's also how Edison got his invention, because there was one problem, a very serious problem, with Léon Scott's phonautograph, and that is it could record, but it could not play back. It could not reproduce. What Edison's phonograph did, and this, of course, was certainly a milestone and incredibly important, Edison invented what we call sound reproduction, because the recordings that Edison made on his phonograph were playable. He actually was recording on tinfoil and making grooves on, or a groove on the tinfoil, and after you had finished your recording, you could play it back and actually get a reproduction. So that's what Edison had really invented in 1877, was the method of reproducing sound, not just recording it. But recording had already been invented 21 years ago, before then.
Now, what were Emil's invention?
Emil was fascinated by the phonograph, and one of the things that he was concerned with was the fact that you could not duplicate with any convenience the cylinders that you recorded. The only way to duplicate an Edison cylinder was by what we call dubbing. That is, you played back your original cylinder recording, and your player was acoustically connected to one or more recorders, and you could therefore make copies of that master cylinder recording. The problem was that the master recording wore out very quickly after being played a few times, and it was no longer any good as a master. So, as a consequence, the method of duplicating cylinders that Edison used was very limited, and the cylinders that were sold were all what we call dubs. And if they were made from a master that had been played too much, why, the quality of those dubs was pretty terrible. My grandfather wanted to invent a method of mass producing cylinders of better quality. And so he set to work on that. He actually did invent it. However, it was never used. It was much easier to mass produce sound recorded on a disc than it was to reproduce in large quantities sound recorded on a cylinder. It is interesting to note that disc recording was also invented by a Frenchman. His name was Charles Cros. He created the concept of recording on a disc way back in 1878. And unfortunately, the Edison invention, actually it was 1877, the Edison invention was announced just prior to the announcement by the French Academy of Science of the Cros method of recording sound on disc instead of cylinder. The consequence of that was that because Edison was famous and Charles Cros was totally unknown, his creation of disc recording was ignored. My grandfather and even Edison, however, knew about Charles Cros's invention, and my grandfather realized when he came to create his method of mass producing unlimited perfect copies from a single master recording, that it was much more convenient to record on a disc instead of on a cylinder. And so, using the lateral cut method of Leon Scott, the disc of Charles Cros, my grandfather came up with a disc record player, which he called the gramophone. Again, using the Greek words gram for grammar and phone for sound. The sound of grammar is a loose translation of the word gramophone, and it's also the same translation for phonograph, phonautograph, and graphophone. They're all from these Greek words. At any rate, the disc record player, and of course he invented a recorder to make the original recordings, were actually an afterthought. He was not trying to invent disc recording or even to create the disc recording industry. He was trying to mass produce discs and cylinders. That's what he had in mind. At any rate, of course, to make a long story short, it didn't work out exactly that way. It worked out even better, because the advent of mass production of disc records completely destroyed the market for cylinder records, and eventually cylinders disappeared. And my father, however, had a cylinder recorder, and he used it for dictating messages for his secretary to later transfer to paper, to letters, that he was sending to people, correspondence. And that actually was Edison's original intention when he created his phonograph. He created it to use as a stenography device. Instead, it ended up both as a stenography equipment, commonly called a dictaphone, but also as the basis for the cylinder record industry, which of course preceded the disc industry by about 10 years.
Another question. Looking back now in the environment of the inventors of sound technology, specifically Edison and Berliner, why is Thomas Edison now so much recognized and Emil is like, yeah?
It's very simple, and it's almost obvious. Item number one, Edison is famous. Emil Berliner never was. Edison had a great ego. He was always seeking publicity. Emil Berliner was a modest man who never sought publicity. That is explanation number one. But explanation number two is even more logical. And that is this. Edison called his recording device a phonograph. And unfortunately, Edison did release discs before he went out of the business. He knew that the cylinder business was dying, that discs would replace it. And so he started to produce discs. And his disc record player was called a disc phonograph. Well, that's part two of my answer to the question. Edison's fame, coupled with his use of the word disc phonograph, meant that Americans, Canadians, Latin Americans, and even the French called the gramophone a phonograph. And that is why few people in the Americas and in France know that the correct word is gramophone, which is used in Germany, Britain, Asia, and so forth. But this is the explanation for why Emil is unknown, Edison is very well known, and Edison gets the credit for things he didn't invent.
Okay. Another question. When did you find out that the Library of Congress wanted to do a special website on Berliner?
I'm not sure when I found out about that. It was probably about 2 years ago. The site has been up, I guess, about 2 years, possibly three. I'm not sure. I had no connection with that Emil Berliner site. It was created by the Library of Congress in Washington, and the man in charge of it who conceived it was Samuel Brilovsky, who is a great fan of Emil Berliner's, I'm happy to say. He's now retired from the Library of Congress. He is a consultant to the library now, but he is essentially the man who created this incredible website, because if you want to study it, I understand it takes hours. I tried to do it, and I had to give up after a while. One of the things I like about the site is that it goes into a lot of personal Berliner family history, some of which is rather embarrassing. However, it doesn't embarrass me at all.
Do you feel pride?
Yes, of course I did. I think it is wonderful. This man who is now being honored by this website has gotten this honor despite the fact that Thomas Edison, his rival, is so well known. And I should point out that Thomas Edison and my grandfather, who never met each other, were rivals in two areas. One was in recorded sound, and the other was in the development of the loose contact principle microphone, which I mentioned earlier. Edison had invented an identical microphone to what my grandfather had invented, and he sold that patent to Western Union Telegraph Company, which sued the Bell system for infringing on the Edison patent. And Bell established that my grandfather had applied for his patent 13 days before Edison, and therefore the Edison patent was of no value. The result of that was that Western Union Telegraph Company, then the only communications company in America, agreed never to go into the telephone business, and American Telephone Company, American Bell Company, changed its name to AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph Company, because they took over all of the telegraph facilities of Western Union, although Western Union continued to use what once was their facilities, but now had become Bell's facilities. Western Union rented them.
Going back to the Library of Congress, did you or were you aware that the Library of Congress wouldn't have another site on Edison or another invented regarding recorded sound?
I'm not familiar with this. The only thing I know about the Library of Congress and Edison was I was told that they had no intention of putting up a Thomas Edison site. That is the extent of my knowledge of that.
Why did Emil Berliner come to Canada?
That's very interesting. In the first place, he was very interested in the Canadian market and got into it actually as quickly as he could. When one considers that it was almost 1900 before Emil got established in the recorded sound business, I think he got to Canada fairly quickly. The Berliner Gramophone Company began in Philadelphia, and across the Delaware River from Philadelphia was the little machine shop of a man by the name of Eldridge Johnson. Johnson was able to design motors for the Berliner Gramophone Company. He was able to overcome manufacturing problems. And Mr. Johnson actually began the manufacture of all the Berliner Gramophones. They were not made by the Berliner Company. Johnson was the subcontractor. And the company in Philadelphia, the Berliner Gramophone Company, was located there to be near the office of Mr. Max Levy. And Max Levy was the inventor of photo engraving. Photo engraving process that Mr. Levy created was the only method of printing photographs in newspapers and magazines. And of course, that was sensational. Emil was using a similar process for the manufacture of discs, and in fact he called it etching the human voice. Won't go into the technical aspects of that, but at any rate, that's why the Berliner Company was located in Philadelphia, because it was convenient to where Max Levy operated. My grandfather very quickly wanted to get launched in Canada, and it was convenient to go to Montreal, which he did in 1899, to arrange for the establishment of the Berliner Gramophone Company of Montreal. It was not the Gramophone Company of Canada at that time. It was the Berliner Gramophone Company of Montreal. And the reason why it was Montreal was Grandpa could get to Montreal by way from Philadelphia and through New York, right up through New York State and into Montreal, because the railroads were doing a very big business on that route. So, and of course, Montreal was the major commercial center of Canada at the time, mainly because of the great French-Canadian workforce and also the nearby location of the St. Lawrence Seaway. Later, I guess Toronto has taken over as the business center of Canada, but Montreal certainly was for years and years and years. That's why Grandpa went to Montreal instead of any other part of Canada. And he formed the gramophone company there, and his oldest son, who was my Uncle Herbert, was put in charge of that company, and it officially was launched on New Year's Day 1900. My Uncle Herbert was running the company, but legally he was not, because Canadian law required that a Canadian be the head of the company that was foreign-owned. At any rate, a man by the name of Emmanuel Blount was engaged to be president, and he was for many years, but actually the company was run by my Uncle Herbert until he was ousted by his father many years later.
Yeah. When Emile came to Canada, did it had to do also with patents and protection of his patents or something like that?
Yes, it did. He went to Canada to exploit the business and also to make use of his patent rights in Canada. For one thing, patent and copyright laws were very curious. They still are, in fact. And he needed world access to patent rights because American patents did not have world access. But Canadian patents were part of the world that the United States was not a part of. And that, of course, that sort of thing existed for many years. It exists in copyright, and it was a terrible situation that has gotten better. But the protection and exploitation of his patents was, of course, paramount in his mind. And I might say, however, that the interesting thing is that the disc recording, the gramophone patents, as it's called, were issued in three countries simultaneously, which is still a very good idea. And the patent was dated November 8th, 1887. And the German patent and the British patent are both dated the same date. A curious thing is the American patent, believe it or not, does not refer to discs. Because, as I said before, Emil was trying to invent a method of mass-producing cylinders, although it was never used for that. But the gramophone patent of the United States doesn't mention the gramophone or discs. Yet the German and British patents issued on the same day in those respective countries do show disc recording and disc manufacture in mass production by pressing the disc. And the wonderful thing about that is that Emil didn't mention disc recording in his American patent because he thought that it would interfere, it would infringe on somebody else's patent. This was a mistake. I think it's wonderful in that these mistakes show up. However, he was not afraid to mention mass production of discs and to mention disc recorders themselves and disc players in the European patents. So it was just a blunder on Emile's part. It was his second blunder. The first one was not taking stock in AT&T. And an interesting thing about today's compact disc, which was an invention of the Dutch company Philips in conjunction with the Japanese company Sony, is that the compact disc of today uses the mass production method created almost 100 years before by my grandfather. And the compact disc of today has six characteristics of the Berliner disc of nearly 100 years before that. That's the amazing thing. For example, the discs are the same size, approximately 5 inches in diameter. They have a center hole. The Berliner patent of the German and British patents show recording on the bottom of the disc instead of the top, which, of course, my grandfather never did, but he specified record on the bottom of the disc. Compact discs, however, are recorded on the bottom. The Berliner disc was a single-face disc. That means recorded on only one side. The compact disc still is recorded only on one side. The Berliner disc uses a continuous groove. The compact disc uses what we call pits. So they are still made on a press in mass production, although with your home CD recorder, you make duplicates in a different way than they do in the pressing plants throughout the world. Anyway, the similarities are tremendous. The oversight by my grandfather didn't work against him, but it is one of his major blunders. But I guess you can't blame the man. Nobody's perfect, and you can't think of everything.
Yeah. Leaving aside sound technologies, your grandfather was interested in a lot of other things, was he not?
Yes, he was. He was interested in two other things. He was interested in aeronautics, and with his youngest son, Henry, who was, of course, also my uncle, Emil invented, or created, I'm not sure if invented is the correct word, but he created what we call a gyroscope, which is an aircraft that is similar to a helicopter. The helicopter does not have wings. The gyroscopic plane, which they call the autogyro, had wings. In fact, Grandpa used a French plane and modified it so it would take off vertically and could fly forward or up and down. Of course, it needed wings. It needed a lot more, however, because his great experiment crashed on its first voyage. For years, the demolished body of the plane was under a staircase in the Smithsonian Institution, and you could go and look at it. It was there, it was on display, but they put it under a staircase because they didn't have any other room for it. So that was one of my grandfather's interests. After leaving that industry, by the way, my Uncle Henry, on his own, as a result of experiments with his father, went on to form a aircraft manufacturing company in Maryland. I think it was in the town of Bethesda. And he produced one of the most unique small airplanes. It was called the Aircoupe, and it was built over many, many years. And it had an amazing feature, which was it was spin-proof. The plane would not go into what they call a tailspin. Therefore, that plane did have the extra protection of not having to succumb to that rather devastating ailment. Anyway, that's what happened as far as my grandfather's inventions and scientific pursuits were concerned. He did, however, go back to Montreal as late as 1919 to do more experiments with manufacturing, pressing of disc records, and making better metalware from which the records were stamped. After that, he devoted his life to public service. He brought pure milk laws to Washington, D.C. That's an interesting story, which we don't have time for. But he was a great humanitarian and was interested in public health. And 10 years after he did his final experiments on disc record manufacture in Montreal, why did he do it in Montreal? Because the Berliner Grammophon Company was there, and it was being run by my father by that time, or shortly thereafter. My father, Edgar, took over from his older brother, Herbert, whom Emil had ousted due to the fact that Herbert, who was responsible for the success of the company, there was no doubt about that, was also responsible for damaging the company to a great extent, that it was losing money, and that Herbert had to be removed. My father, Edgar, took over. At any rate, 10 years after Emil did his final experiments in Montreal, he died. He was not in the record business, the telephone business, or any business at that time. He was totally retired. And, in fact, the last pursuits of his in the record business were in Montreal.